Once more under the breach, dear friends, else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen. This is a second hour of the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure. We're going to talk about finance, the economy, marketplace, and other things that you can call in and ask. Personal finance, and what you won't hear me do is give personalized advice. I'm not going to make recommendations on buying and selling. Why? Because if I make the recommendation to one of you, it's probably not the right thing for another one of you to do. It's not one size fits all advice. There's no such thing when it comes to the fine points of actual advice. Education's different. We can talk about principles. And talking about the principles of investing and the principles of what it is that makes a good investor, what is the discipline, what is the long-term approach, yeah, we can talk about that. We can talk about what makes a bond price go up and down with interest rates, what causes the stock market to move. And there's some really simple answers to that that can get as complicated as you want or as simple as you want. And if we want to keep it simple, the reason why the stock market moves up or down, the only reason you can get in and say, well, this is why that reason happens, but the only real reason why the stock market moves is because more people are trying to buy than people trying to sell. And it's a simple auction environment. And if the stock market is going down, it's because more people are trying to sell than are trying to buy. It's if you think of an auction, if you go to an auction place, you're bidding on a harmonica. And a lot of people in the room want that harmonica, the price is going to go up. If nobody in the room wants that harmonica and there's 20 of them to be sold, the price is going to come down unless the bidder said, hey, I won't take less than this amount. By the way, that's called a limit order in the stock market. It's an auction. And when people wonder why it is that the stock market is down this week, is it, does it have to do with interest rates? Does it have to do with other portions of the economy? Is it trade? What is it? Well, the reality is that a few more people are trying to sell than are trying to buy when the market drops as much as it did this last week, which is only about 1%. You know, people talk about the market's really getting beat up. It's not. It's down about 1% for the week. And it's down because we've had some pretty major revelations over the last couple of weeks. We had a new tariff on China. It looks like we have a preliminary agreement on trade with Canada and Mexico. It's not NAFTA anymore. Whether or not this agreement is finalized is still waiting to see, because there's going to be a new president in Mexico that is going to have to agree to it as well. So not all of the votes are in on that. But the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement is in essence the same verbiage as NAFTA with some relatively minor changes to it. That was a big deal, and people are still digesting this. There's 1,700 pages to this new agreement, which is slightly longer than NAFTA. And it's not horrible. It's not something that's too hard to read, because when we talk about this sort of thing, when we say 1,700 pages, each page is a single kind of newspaper-type column. It's not as, I mean, if you looked at one page of a newspaper, that'd be like 40 or not quite that much. Probably 7 or 8 pages of a law. Just the same verbiage. So if we're looking at this, it's not insurmountable. I haven't read the whole thing yet because it's not final. Once we have beyond the preliminary and we say this is where we are, I have read snippets. And I know people say, what are you doing reading all these things? Well, it's going to affect us. And if we're upset that a lawmaker isn't reading a bill before passing it, I'm giving advice on this stuff, so I should probably read it too. What I can say is that the differences are relatively minor between NAFTA and the USMCA. Very small things, like minor upgrade in how much work has to be charged at a higher dollarly rate, hourly rate, the specifics of the dairy trade with Canada, they have loosened some of their import requirements on dairy. They had quotas and they had specific things laid out, very much like our corn industry or rice industry or most of our agricultural area. They have altered their quota system to look a little bit more like the United States dairy system, which means that there's subsidies being used instead of quotas. Does it mean that the government's less involved? No, but so that's what's happened today, or this last week. We've got this backlog of data that people have to look at. We have to say, all right, what does this mean to you? What does this mean to me? What does it mean to the companies involved? Ford came out and said something a little bit on the scary side, that if the tariffs are not changed this time next year, they're going to lose $1 billion. $1 billion. That's a lot of money for anybody to lose. It'd be not something I could recover from if I lost $1 billion, because I don't have $1 billion. But Ford has billions of dollars. They are in a place where they have clearly said if the tariffs stay in place, they're going to lose a lot of money. And they're not the only ones. There's a lot of companies that are in that boat, because as of right now, the companies are eating a lot of that tariff cost. They don't want to raise the prices, because if Ford raises the prices of a truck to fill in the cost that it's trying to eat right now, then Americans are more likely to buy a truck from Toyota. That's a real thing. I mean, that for many years, all of the motorcycle rallies at all of the cattle auctions, you could go in the motorcycle rally and you wouldn't see foreign-made motorcycles. If you went to a cattle auction, you could walk through that parking lot and it was 100% American-made goods. It's not true anymore. That means even the most patriotic people take price into effect. They account for prices. If something costs a lot more and you're not getting a lot more quality for it, then you buy at the lower price. Walmart for many years was made in America only. That stopped a long time ago when they started losing sales to people like Target that, you know, they were having imported things. They're just, the prices of American-made goods are very high, which is good for us when we're exporting. We get money out of it. But if we want to keep a standard of living, if we want to keep the prices down, imported items are a must. Walmart's not going to eat the profit or eat the loss and not have a profit. Ford's not going to eat the loss and not have a profit indefinitely. That means prices are going to come up. And we have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Caller? Hello?
All right. You're not on the air anymore. All right, so on that note, I'm going to throw in some good news here. There's a lot of good news out there, and a lot of people are covering the good news. So usually when there's only bad news out there, we're throwing in a lot of good news. When there's a lot of good news out there, we throw in a lot of bad news. The good news that I'm about to throw out there, it isn't because there's a lot of bad news in the media, because it's kind of, most of the news is political in nature. The good news is that there have been announcements from two major universities that they are going to cover the cost of tuition. 100%. New York University is covering the cost, 100% cost, for all medical school. That's awesome. You know, one of the things that I have talked about and complained about for many years is that we have a system of public schools in the United States that have been raising their tuition without a lot of explanation for why. Their endowment funds have been growing hugely. The price that or the wages for the professors have gone up. they are not accepting a whole lot of new students, and they're not expanding or hiring. They're just raising the wages, and that's a problem. Well, New York University stepped back and said, "All right, we're gonna pay for tuition for medical students." That's fantastic. Does that mean that everybody should go to New York if you want to go to medical school? No, because the cost of move might be enough to make you change your mind, and it's not the only place that that is happening. Rice University. Rice University is not eliminating tuition for just one department, not just the medical or whatever. Rice University is eliminating tuition for all but the wealthiest students. Just across the board, they've got $5.5 billion in their endowment fund. What is a university's endowment fund for? Well, it's to fund the university. That's what it's for. That is the sole purpose of an endowment fund for a university, is to fund the university. And when you're raising your tuition consistently year over year while your endowment is growing massively, this is a good move. It's a great marketing move by Rice. Why is it marketing if they're giving it away for free? Well, because they don't have to always give it away for free, and they're not giving it away for free for everybody. They're giving it away for almost everybody. About 80% of the students are going to go there for free now. 20%, the parents that have lots and lots of money that weren't qualified for educational aid in any way anyway, are going to need to continue to pay the tuition. But the tuition hasn't gone up this year or the year before. So this is great news on the tuition front. If you've got kids heading off to school sometime soon, this is the beginning of something that I expect to see continue for quite some time, because the college inflation rate, just like medical inflation rate, it's been astronomical. The colleges have and universities have a lot more control on the costs than the doctors do. So a professor has a lot more say to the administration of a university than a doctor does to the administration of the massive group that owns all the hospitals in the area. So they can go in and say, "Hey, my students are complaining about tuition. It's just way too high." Where the doctor comes in and says, "My patients are complaining." They're not complaining to the doctor yet because they haven't gotten the bill yet, and they won't get the bill for some unknown period of time. So anyway, there's good news out there. Another bit of good news, which ironically caused the market to go down, which is in itself good news. 3.7% unemployment. We have not seen that kind of low unemployment since 1969. And people are saying, "Oh, well, it's quite funny." I've got to throw in some more irony here on the political side. When I said unemployment rates are low during Barack Obama's presidency, the Republicans would respond to me, "Oh, you're not counting the participation rate. You're not counting the people that are completely out of the workforce now that aren't even looking for jobs." I don't hear that from Republicans anymore. I'm hearing that from Democrats now. When I quote the unemployment rate, they say, "Well, you're not counting the participation rate." Well, I am. The participation rate has a big, if you're looking at a timeline starting in 1948. Why 1948? Because the participation rate was really, really high before that. It was a war thing. Everybody was working. Even people that weren't working were working because they had to, because we were fighting a big war. The participation rate following World War II was about 58%. It kind of hovered around there, jumped up to 60% a few times. But right around the late 60s, the participation rate jumped up. Well, what happened there that caused the participation rate to jump up? And how high did it get? We're talking about hovering around 60, and it jumped up to 67 or so. And it jumped up to 67 or so in the early 90s. So what caused that sharp increase over the period of several decades of the participation rate going up. Well, a new generation did. If you're listening to this, the likelihood is that you're a baby boomer. You're the reason why the participation rate went up. Because your parents and your aunts and younger aunts and uncles, the ladies probably were not in the workforce. The baby boom generation came along. I'm a Generation Xer, so I'm giving you credit where it's due. And you came up with this concept of a dual earner family, two people working. And that caused the participation rate to jump way, way up. And generations that have followed the baby boomers are not as focused on dual income. Some people say it's a work ethic thing. Some people say otherwise. But the reality is that they look around and they're putting priorities on either family or whatever, the same reason anybody else does. And the fact that the baby boom participation rate was up at the 67% means that there were priorities being put on family then as well. So we've got fewer kids. Parents are spending more time with their kids than they did before because there's fewer of them. And this is one of those other opposite moments. At the turn of the 20th century, it was pretty normal for people to have 6 to 9 children. And the people that garnered the most respect were the elderly. Anybody that had white hair got a lot of attention. They got a lot of time. Now we have a lot fewer children and a lot more older people. So it's supply and demand one more time, only instead of with money, it's with respect. I'm not saying this is good or bad, but you can see it happening. And at that point, people were not shifting off the elderly to someone else's care. Today, that's a pretty normal factor. So demographics have a lot to do with the participation rate. We've had a drop in the participation rate starting in 2008. You got a couple of things. Well, people say, well, duh, 2008 is when the market was dropping and we had this big recession, so big they called it great. Yes, we had the Great Recession. What caused the Great Recession? Well, mortgages and the bankers and bank fraud and all that stuff. Yes, but what caused the bankers to do that? What caused the bank fraud? What caused the people to take on multiple mortgages? The baby boomers were concentrating on retirement, getting very close. 2008 is 65 years after 1943, which is when the first group of people was saying that the baby boom started. So the beginning wave of the baby boom started to retire in 2008. We had a Great Recession that corresponded to it that was led up to with a bunch of bad mortgages, a lot of people getting loans for houses they couldn't pay for, a lot of bankers trying to make a lot of money off of people making money getting loans that they couldn't pay for. And that there's a funny thing there, and that bankers, you can't make money off of people that can't afford to pay you, and people that are blaming the bankers, and there's enough blame to go around everywhere here. People tend to upgrade their houses right before retirement, and then once they're right next to retirement, they tend to downgrade their retirement home. They go, whoa, this is way too big. I got my dream house for my entire life, and it's too big for my retirement, so I want to get rid of it. That was a big factor in the Great Recession. The participation rate started dropping there at a time, you know, when we've got unemployment's fully recovered plus some. The people back in the workforce have not. Now, it makes it sound like it's all the baby boomers' fault. When we drill into the numbers, people above the age of 65, their participation rate has come way up by multiple percentage points. And you can look at the statistics at the Bureau of Labor Statistics. You can see this group of people above the age of 65, more of them are working today as a participation in the workforce than even 4 years ago. If you look at the group between age 45 and 60, you'll see the participation rate drops there. That's the biggest point of drop in the participation rate. And that comes in very nicely with the opioid epidemic, with the fact that mothers and fathers have waited to have kids till later in life, and this is the point where one of the earners or the other is stepping back to help prepare the kids for college, and I've seen that quite a lot. They're not looking for a job because they have put a priority on getting the kid to college. Now, they may go back to work, and many people that I've talked to have said that they're planning on going back. So, yes, it is a real 3.7% unemployment. Of the people that are looking for jobs, that want jobs, all but 3.7% have them. Congratulations. That is fantastic. This is not a number I would have said 10 years ago. I would have looked at that and said, no way we can get down to that anytime soon. So congratulations to the workforce. We probably would also not be down to 3.7% without the tax cut. Now, there's a probably there because it's really hard to prove a negative. We did pass the tax bill. So whether or not it's good long term for the health of the economy is irrelevant for this discussion. The concept of the low unemployment rate being this low at this point in a economic cycle is fantastic, and we can give credit where it's due. That goes to the President of the United States, President Trump. Now, the long-term consequences haven't been measured yet. We've got this great time period now, and it comes back, and this is the same thing that we have said week after week after week for about 2.5 years, and you'll notice that's 2.5 years. That was before we knew who was going to be president. It was either going to be Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, and what we were saying is that first year, the market is set to jump up. It may go up higher based on tax changes or not, but the reality is the market's set to jump up because it hasn't, and the earnings have risen. Now we come forward, the president was elected. We had a year where no major economic policies were changed, and we had a massive run-up in the market, followed by 2018. Major economic policies have changed. We've got tariffs, we've got tax law changes, and the market's flat. That isn't the market saying we don't like these changes. It's the market saying we're trying to digest what's going on. The market has not crashed. It's flat. So we should all be taking that moment to digest a moment, say, what's the next step? The next step should always be priorities on short-term savings. And it's like it would come back to a broken record player. These are fundamental truisms about investing, going back as far back as you want to measure. All right, I've got to play some more commercials. And I'll be back on the other side of the Personal Wealth Coach. We've got another group of commercials to play after that. But I've got some other articles about why Americans are retiring later. There's some the companies out there on about earnings that are basically starting to come out this week. Companies are telling analysts, you're raising the earnings in your expectations too high. Keep them down. So we'll talk about that as well. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to join the conversation, the number in here is 254-773-1400. And I'm back. More of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to join the conversation, if you've got a question or would like me to talk on a different subject, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400. And I said before we went to break, why are Americans retiring later? Are they? Yes, they are. It was kind of a statement, you know, you ask a question about it. It fills in the blanks there. Yes, people are retiring later. Why is that? Well, there's a couple of reasons. First, probably most important reason has nothing to do with living longer. Because people at age 62 or 66 or 67 or 65 are not saying, I have 3 years to live in the most case. usually they're saying, I don't know how long I have, but I might have 30 years. This should be good. And they've been saying that for years. And most people in the past have not had 30 years, but they still said, I might have 30 years of retirement. So it isn't longevity. It has a lot to do with Alan Greenspan. Greenspan, before he was chairman of the Federal Reserve, led the Greenspan Commission back in 1983. This was the last time that the Social Security Administration was eating into the trust fund. They weren't taking in enough money to pay retirement only from the tax that's charged for Social Security. So Alan Greenspan said, well, we got to raise the retirement age. We got to go from age 65. Yes, I know people don't even remember when 65 was the retirement age for Social Security in many cases. 65 was the age, just like Medicare. They were tied together. They were sort of brought together at the same time. And Medicare is in a lot worse shape than Social Security because the Greenspan Commission didn't say raise the retirement age for Medicare. So they did. And now we're all the way through. Now, as this year, you've got to be 66 years in order to get the full retirement age for Social Security. And it's being ratcheted up over time, over the next, I think, till 2022, it will be all the way up to 67. And that's extending the lifespan of Social Security. It also is causing people to retire later. You can still retire early at age 62, but the discount that you're taking on your retirement is 30% instead of 20%. Again, that goes back to Alan Greenspan. He said people are retiring early. We gotta lower the rate a little bit, so give them some incentive to start retiring later. It tells you something. If they want you to retire later, it's because they don't think that they can pay everybody. If everybody retires early, Social Security would break. It's already breaking. It would be broken. So they put some incentives in there to try to make people wait longer. It may not be the best move. We do these at the office. We do an analysis on Social Security to see when the best time is to start taking it for each person, because it's different for every person. There is no rule that says everybody should do it one way or another. So people are retiring later. Another reason for that, as I just said that before the break, the participation rate is up among the older people. They're retiring later, and part of that is because of the Great Recession. Many people didn't have a job, and they were trying to earn during that time period to provide for their retirement. They had either an early retirement that they didn't want, it was taking less than they wanted, and they went back to work. And at this point, wages are coming up. So it's tempting out the people that have already retired to say, hey, I'll go back to that. I've got quite a number of successful people as clients that have gone back to work. They don't need to, absolutely have no need financially to go back to work. But they're doing it anyway because they get enjoyment out of it and because it is padding their later retirement. It's giving them more for later. That's an important factor. Now I'm going to jump back over to another couple of conversation pieces. We've been talking about one of the major bottlenecks in the marketplace. Not the market, but in the economy. One of the major bottlenecks is transportation. With the new tariffs, a lot of stuff, and stuff is a technical term, and goods, things that are being imported, are stopping at the ports because we don't have enough customs enforcement folks out there to inspect to figure out who owes what. And they've got to inspect. It's kind of an important factor here. We have not increased our customs team anywhere near enough to deal with this many new tariffs. So it's slowing down the import process. The large corporations have been able to deal with it because they go to specific large corporation customs things and they say this is what we have and there's bigger consequences. It's the small items, the people across the world that are shipping to us in smaller quantities, but there's a lot of it. And so that's slowing down. bottlenecks in truck driving. And this is a factor. Truck orders, rig orders have been way, way, way up throughout 2017 and into 2018. We've just seen the first drop in new truck orders. And the reason why we're seeing the drop is because a truck, a tractor truck, these huge things, they're not cheap. And when you drop down a lot of money on these big machines, you want that machine to last as long as you possibly can. And the surveys for the purchasing officers are saying something similar to what I recently had a conversation with my wife about. The next car we get, I'd like to hang on to these two cars. They're pretty good cars. We've got each have our car, and we want to hang on to them for a while. The next car we get, we want it to drive itself. Because there's nothing like buying the newest, greatest car that allows you to drive it to have a year later the newest, greatest car has self-driving and even the middle of the road, no, not middle of the road, but middle of the road prices cars would be driving themselves in the near future, 5-6 years. So can we make it 5 or 6 years? Another factor, prices on trucks are way, 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 way up. Prices on new automobiles are also way, way up. The average cost for a new car, the average payment is at $523 a month. That's a lot of money. We're starting to see the inflation stuff kicking in. We're at a record high monthly amount, and just go back 3 years and you're down at the 450 level. So to come up $85, we're talking about a significant increase from $450 a month. We're talking about near 20% increase in prices. Think about that for a second. That's going to slow down auto trade. It's going to any trades that are taking place. There's other statistics that are showing, surprisingly, people are using their cars for longer. People are using the truck longer. So truck sale orders are down. These are the big trucks. Truck sales orders are way up in the self-driving area, even though the prototypes are only out there and being tested. They haven't started the grand manufacturing process of doing a lot of self-driving. But almost, well, I don't know of any major truck manufacturer that isn't spending huge amounts of money on self-driving technology, just like I don't know of any major car or automobile manufacturer that's not spending huge amounts of money on self-driving. So expect that play a little bit of havoc with the norm for purchasing of automobiles and trucks. We still have the bottleneck. We don't have enough drivers. We don't have enough trucks on the road. That's slowing down trade, which means that we're going back to older models. People are ordering larger amounts. It's not real-time ordering. You know, one of the things that Walmart and more specifically McLean's, based right here in Temple, developed that created the extravagant life that we live today is that when you purchase something at the store is already ordering the thing that you purchased to put back on the shelf. Real-time ordering. It got rid of many, many warehouses. If you go to Dallas or to Austin or to Fort Worth or any other major metropolitan center, the old warehouse districts are turning into condominiums, or many of them already have become condominiums. With the slowdown of transport, with the slowdown of import and of trade, warehouses may have to make a comeback, which could be good for some people. It's not going to be great for the manufacturers or for the selling people, because traditionally recessions start when too much goods are ordered and are sitting in a warehouse and not able to sell. So these companies have spent a lot of money and they haven't gotten the profit out of it that they expected. That real-time purchase saved a lot of uncertainty. It allowed companies to know that they were only buying something to replace something that actually got sold. So there's some interesting facts out there. We've got some more commercials that I've got to play. I'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to join the conversation, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400, and I'll be back on the other side. And I'm back. This is Jake McClure. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and I have a scary subject, or at least some people have said this was a scary subject, so I'm going to bring it up. We were just talking about self-driving automobiles, self-driving trucks, truck drivers being a well-paid job, not extremely lucrative, but getting more so because there's not enough of them. What happens when they're replaced by machines that do it for them? Why is that scary? Well, a lot of people have said to me that that's scary because people forget the skills. You're going to forget skills if you're in an industrial facility and they're creating a large item and the machines are doing it instead of the people. Well, what happens if the machines break? How do we go in and make it from scratch? And what I have to tell people that are afraid of that is that we're already there. Many, 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 many people, I would even venture to say the majority of people, do not know how the light switch works. They know electricity is involved, but they don't know the difference between voltage and amperage. They certainly don't know how to get behind a horse pulling a plow. The skills of an era get lost with new technology. Hopefully not lost, hopefully recorded. There's a great documentary series. You can go to YouTube and look it for timeline documentaries. And it's mostly British, but they're archaeologists that are, well, there's one example of they're rebuilding a castle because we don't know how they built castles. We've got some idea of what tools they used, but how did they do it all? So it's a 25-year project to document the skills that they were using to build a castle. We lost those skills. Many people do not know how to grow garden vegetables. This is something that we could still use today. Going out and growing the garden vegetables, people don't know how to do that. A lot of people don't know how to do that. How many people have you said, have you heard say, I just don't have a green thumb? As if somehow you're supposed to be born with the knowledge of how to nurture a plant. You're not born with that. If we were, then newborns could do it. Plant growth is a skill. It's a skill you learn. It's not a talent. It's not, you know, I'm talented with plants. No, you've got a skill that you've learned, and it may be something you were really interested in, so you learned it really fast or really quickly. But the reality is that green thumb is something you earn, not something you're born with. Well, unless it's some kind of a weird mutation for the pigment in the skin. That's a different issue, and I'm not a doctor. So this concept of losing skills because machines do it is something that we started when the first person broke a stick and started using it instead of their fingers. Tool use, we upgrade our tools regularly. That doesn't mean you shouldn't study how to do it without the tool. I encourage that. That's what I just did with the documentary thing. But I don't expect you to go out and build a castle using the old tools. That would be a little bit absurd. So if you've got a new, better tool to do a job, you should use that better tool, even if it means you don't do the job, even if it means the tool does the job. Just ask the horses. You know, horses used to pull the wagons. Now we put horses in wagons to take them places to ride them. Technology replaces tools. And one of the tools that is likely to be replaced is us in many, many areas. What does that mean? What does that leave us with? Well, as long as we are the ones that say, I want this item, and a machine makes it for us, somebody owns that machine, and then we will own the item that comes to us. The vast majority of people in the United States own part of the United States. That's a good thing. It's not true in the vast majority of the world. As long as we continue to own our country as citizens, as entrepreneurs, as business people, as just investors, we have ownership of those machines that are replacing us. They're not really replacing us. They're better than us. If we look at the statistics on self-driving cars, the accident rate drops drastically. And here's some interesting statistics, and this is, they change every year, and I don't have the most up-to-date. But the accident rate for your average person is lower than the accident rate for a taxi driver, because taxi drivers drive a lot more. They may even be better drivers than your average person, but they get into more accidents. Self-driving cars, eventually, we will have no accidents. We killed 37,000 people on the roads last year. That's a lot of people. It's the number one fatality cause for children in the United States. It's not disease, it's not diabetes or obesity or any of the other things that get the big news headlines. It's vehicles, it's cars. And when cars are driving themselves, instead of, you know, I've got a three-year-old. If I'm driving in my car, I'm behind the steering wheel, and she starts yelling, screaming for whatever reason, she bit her tongue or she spilled her drink or whatever it may be, I am not the most observant driver at that moment. I don't care how good I am at driving for the rest of the time. At that moment, I'm not. The accident rate for Tesla's car manufacturing is the same as Ford or very close to it. They have more fires, but their injury rate is drastically lower because there's a lot fewer people out there doing it. They are coming out with a much lower priced car in the very near future. I mean, they're bringing a price down on a car that has the ability to self-drive for certain periods of time. And that price is coming down into below the average new car price. So looking forward at these new technologies as they come along, each new technology does replace a skill set. If you think about a machinist today that has to build a specific part, whether that's for an oil rig or, well, we'll use oil rig. You're building a collet for an oil rig, and it requires somebody with a great deal of know-how to do it, except that right next to them is a CNC, a computer numeric controlled machine, that is making a great deal of the same parts with less people involved. Are we eventually going to, for the most part, forget the skills of machining? Probably. There will still be people that do it in a niche type market. But the vast majority of machinists are not going to be machinists anymore, because a machine is a better machinist. They are a lot more accurate. We've got to use a whole series of different measurement tools when we're doing machining, where the computer doesn't have to stop to measure to see if it's the right size. It just only cuts to the right size. So don't be afraid of this robotics revolution that's coming. It's going to lead to a lot of unemployment. You're forearmed if you're hearing me now. Forearmed. I have two forearms, by the way, just to let you know. But you are forewarned. You know what's going to happen. So find ways to be an owner of the economy rather than a participant in the economy. We're all consumers to some extent. Hopefully people are consuming what we are selling too. If we have a consumer-based economy, the consumers need to learn to sell things to other people to consume as well, even if we're not directly doing it. And that's a big, long-term thing. Machines are going to take over a lot of the positions that we have on hand. They're much better at reading medical tests. They don't miss the things that they're not looking at, because they look at it all. They're still not good at diagnosing. Watson was kicked out of Johns Hopkins. Watson, the AI from IBM, it's a fantastic device. It's an amazing machine, but it's not ready to make diagnoses as yet. How do you say diagnosis multiple times? Diagnoses? It's like indexes. Indices? Diagnoses? Anyway, the AI is going to get there. DARPA did a challenge for many, many years. DARPA is the Defense Research Program. It's a Defense and Armed Forces Research Program that they spent a lot of money on new technology. And they did an event for many years, a decade. And it was an autonomous vehicle getting through a desert obstacle course that was, I think it was only 2 miles long. And for a decade, no one was able to finish the course. The first year that someone was able to finish the course, all the teams that entered finished the course. That's how technology growth works. So expect it, look forward to it, and plan for it so that you're not crushed by it, because the people that are crushed by it are the ones that are oblivious to it. Know that it's going to happen and hang on to the skills that you have, because it's the sort of thing that when we tell our grandkids that, yes, I used to drive a car when many, many people were killed every year in cars, and yes, the only thing keeping me apart from those cars was a different colored line on the pavement, but I survived. So I'm about done for this week. Thank you for listening. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to call off the air, we do give independent and fiduciary investment advice. The phone number to call is 254-947-1111 or 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email me at jake@tpwc.com. You can email Jeff at jeff@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can listen to recordings of our programs into the past and future.